Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 9 of the Courage to Thrive show. On today's episode, Reverend Dr. Robert Flanagan will interview Daniel Grace about his debut novel, In the Wake of Golgotha. It is a fascinating story that you will not want to put down once you pick it up. So I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, proud producer of the show on Incandescent Radio, Incandescent TV, and you can find us on Spotify, Apple, and iHeart. Now I'm going to throw it over to Bob to find out about this fantastic story. Take it away, sir.
Thanks, Hope, and welcome, Daniel, to Courage to Thrive. I'm so happy to have you on. Yeah, it's looking. I really enjoyed spending time with your book, and so to have you on now is really great. And I would say before we get you involved in all of this, that my thinking is now for the podcast is to do the July podcast episode to be one that where we focus on a book for the summer read for those people who take time off in August. So this is a perfect time to have you on, so everybody can make their orders on Amazon and get a book in for beach reading or mountain reading or just sitting by the pool or just sitting in the coffee shop out of the heat.
Amazing. Well,
yeah
Bob, it's a pleasure to be on with you. And, you know, I should say at the outset, you know, despite your introduction, I think it's hilarious because, you know, this book that we're going to talk about today, it's the furthest thing from a traditional beach read, but it
oh,
doesn't mean
absolutely.
It can't be read at the beach.
Oh, absolutely. No, I totally agree with you. Yeah. It could be read at the beach, but it has its, it really strikes interesting questions, you know? So, I mean, so let's kick off from there. So, you have a fascinating personal journey from on the way to becoming an author, and I'd love to hear about what influenced your writing and how you got to where you are now.
Sure. So my background, as you say, pretty circuitous to the page, if you will. But writing's always been, you know, kind of something that I've done throughout my career. And earlier in my career, I started in advertising. I owned an advertising agency for years and years. And obviously kind of that storytelling, you know, rings true to mythology, be it of brand and sort of striking a chord intellectually and emotionally with various audiences. And then when I transitioned into becoming a winemaker, and I manage a family property in Tuscany. I have the great good fortune of doing that. You know, while many might consider that's a stretch from advertising, you know, like anything, it's mythology, right? And making wine and, you know, communicating the story of time and place and fruit and soil. It's mythology. And so it's interesting how it's in many ways such not a stretch. And I, you know, toiling in fields that, you know, were first planted by Franciscan monks in the 1400s, you know, that's an inspiring place to be, being on a property where there's a 2,000-year-old pre-Etruscan trail. You know, you talk about inspiration. And so you know, it feels like a pretty distant path from A to B, but it's oddly well connected.
Nice. Oh, that's good. That's cool. Yeah. So what's also interesting, certainly about your book, we can tell from the title, The Wake of Golgotha. Not everybody will know what Golgotha means. I don't want to, I'll leave it as a cliffhanger there for, you know, Christians, certainly Christians that are familiar with Holy Week are familiar with the word Golgotha. And so, I'd love to hear about, where in your life were the moments really in your spiritual journey that stand out and have shaped you as a person? That'd be interesting.
Sure.
Yeah.
Interesting question. I had the, just because of my family background, I had the sort of the interesting sort of upbringing of growing up both in London and in California. But my father, who was sort of Jesuit trained and schooled, was in the seminary. So out of the gate, kind of coming into, you know, a pretty spiritual sort of family environment, and then going to a Jesuit university myself, and being a philosophy major, being a theater major, I think there were questions of spirituality and faith and fate and choice and existentialism, frankly, since, as long as I can remember. And so I think being kind of in my more former years, kind of schooled by Jesuits, who have a little bit more of a philosophical approach to some of these questions of faith, it always leads with that question. It always leads with that premise in many ways of sort of two sides to every story. And so when it came to, again, mythology, and be it biblical mythology, be it Greek mythology, Roman mythology, a classic or modern literary mythology, my compass always led me down a trail of sort of two sides to every soul, two sides to every story, two sides to every hill, frankly. And so it's sort of, and again, informing in many ways my professional career. And as silly as it sounds, even when it's, prescriptively writing about, global blockbuster bank brands and technology brands, wine as well, it's a similar, it's a similar outlook.
Cool. Yeah. So do you feel that there was, so what was, other than your Jesuit, your Jesuit training, and I totally get the Jesuit idea of being a critical thinker and what that central piece to the academic side of Ignatian spirituality. What brought you, this is your first novel, so what brought you to doing something that is so really so deeply tied into Christianity, and but more than that, tied into questions of faith and spirituality. So was there a question that you that was gnawing at you? Was there, an idea that struck you in the middle of the night? And so how did that process come about for you?
Sure. At its core, kind of the genesis, I guess, pun intended, and kind of the seeds of the story ultimately were born out of a reflection of sort of the dawn of the digital age. And bear with me for a minute. And it really came from a reflection of kind of a study of literature. And I was struck by kind of the death of legend as the last century ended, and as we headed into the digital age, that became very much sort of this mere reflection. It was a me self-centered sort of culture and philosophy, and it was about my voice and my broadcast and my image. And I was struck by sort of this death, again, of mythology. I was struck by this idea of sort of the death of the hero and the anti-hero, and how, again, going back to biblical mythology, Greek and Roman mythology, literary mythology, but even superheroes, and this notion of sort of the role that heroes and anti-heroes played in culture to kind of define our collective compass, it kind of fell by the wayside, and it became less relevant. And so I was just sort of struck with this idea. And so the story was born out of sort of this notion of kind of this gathering at a wake of the death of legend, right? And that whether that's sort of a Christ-like character, whether that's literally like a comic book superhero kind of Superman type of character, whether it's sort of a Shakespearean character, again, kind of the ego and the id play of hero and anti-hero. And when I created this cast of characters at this wake of legend, one of the anti-heroes that was present in my mind's story was the character and the person, the historical figure of Judas Iscariot. And I then slipped and tumbled headfirst down a pretty steep rabbit hole, about kind of questioning the context of this particular character, and then in doing so was struck by kind of this parallel timeless tumble through history of Pontius Pilate as well. And again, both being kind of cast and prescribed as sort of this anti-hero. And so really that then became the shift of the story, was there's an opportunity to have a dialogue around these two particular characters, who I felt had been, and this is an extreme take, but sort of lynched by history and by culture and by religion, in a way that I felt was kind of lacked the context of most anti-heroes. And so, and these aren't necessarily original thoughts. You'd asked about inspiration before as well. I mean, in my high school years, a book that kind of changed my view on literature was Nikos Kazantzakis' Last Temptation of Christ. And just that way that one, you can have dialogue and you can question historical and biblical and cultural narratives. And so this idea of not necessarily a sympathetic view of these characters, but again, taking a second look at such fundamental, profound, real people who played such a pivotal role in history, that it's not that it's fair game to reimagine kind of their context and their motivations. But again, for lack of a better word, why not? Without questioning kind of the primary players, right? This is, the original story, and this story, the book that's sitting next to me, it's not at all a book about Christ, right? It's a book
Oh,
about
absolutely.
Christ Hill, the hill, and sort of the cast of characters who kind of enabled this moment atop Calvary Hill.
That's interesting you bring that up. I mean, I as I recall, in the early church literature that we have available to us, what we call the New Testament Apocrypha, that material, we have things like the Gospel of Peter and the Gospel of Andrew, of course, most recently, Gospel of Thomas made a lot of wake, a lot of news, because did it provide us with something more? Did it tell us something about Mary that we didn't know? And so in that book, there is some stories attributed by name to Pilate, but there's nothing attributed to Judas, obviously. He was dead, and so it's as you say, you're not this book is not about that one, the Holy Week moment. It takes that moment and takes several characters and then moves on in a powerful way. And one of those, one of the things you do is your characters cross kind of thousands of years, retain what I call is they retain their original personhood in them. They're not the 21st century characters that you portray are not possessed by these other past people. They're not, it's not like it's each of these characters in their own way has their own autonomy and a personhood and agency, but they are kind of influenced, as I would say, in a sense of kind of what would be called as past lives, what Brian Weiss wrote about in his series of books, one of which was Many Lives, Many Masters, looking in his work as a psychiatrist, a practicing psychiatrist in the last half of the 20th century and into this century, is that he came across people who were wounded in somehow in a strange way, and he kind of stumbled upon this idea that people embody somehow past lives. And I couldn't help but thinking about your book as I was reading it, thinking, wow, I wonder how you feel about this. Was it something you were aware of when you were writing? And if so, please tell more.
Yeah, no, it's whether we're talking about Calvary Hill, whether we're talking about sort of this broad notion of even reincarnation, sometimes these are it's thin ice, right? These can be some taboo issues, and so you step forward delicately, and so what I was trying to project was, there are whispers back to Calvary Hill and Gethsemane and ancient Jerusalem and ancient Rome, for that matter. But in sort of reimagining these two characters, sort of struggling and toiling and wrestling with guilt and sin and hope and fear in the 21st century, was this sort of, again, it's we're dealing with a subject matter that's this sort of this looming eternal shadow of the cross atop Golgotha, and therefore sort of my intention was to kind of capture these two wandering lost souls that are still in that shadow of that cross. And so kind of the term in my mind that I was sort of playing with was again this sort of this the shadow of their original soul. And so while it's not this explicit, direct, kind of easy translation of reincarnation time after time, and as you say, wanting to give them independence and autonomy and have again sort of these the whispers and in different kind of scenarios, but have sort of this symphony of chaos that reset the calendar 2,000 years ago, be ever present and ever whispering and ever stirring and ever simmering in both of their souls. And sort of really, it's a story of sort of their individual realization and sort of then this sort of clash of realizations. And so, you know, for me, even just in thinking about it, I sort of resisted the idea of, you know, this isn't a story about reincarnation. But really, where I started, it's a story of damnation. And I guess a story of salvation. And so with that sense of just that word damnation, that also became kind of my, from a vocabulary perspective and sort of thesis perspective, my compass as well. Like it was, this is a story of damnation. And it's a story, you know, and again, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but it's in thinking about these two specific characters and their passage through their respective damnations, you know, it's really a story of every man's and every woman's sort of struggle uphill and the fears and the hopes and the hopelessness and the pain and the sorrow and the guilt and the sin but also the salvation that we all carry up our own hills. And so you know, so again, it's you know, we all have whispers of, you know, I might regard coming from it from a place of faith, that we all have those whispers of that symphony of this moment of conflict and conquest that happened atop Golgotha 2,000 years ago. It exists in all of us. And so to me, it's, I hear those same stirring echoes of that same symphony. And so it's, to me, it wasn't a stretch. And I'm, you know, I wasn't there. I know that for sure. But yet, why do I hear that symphony warming up when it comes to morality and when it comes to kind of my own struggle of ego and it? And so to me, all of a sudden, it became a much more real sort of projection.
Oh, that's interesting. So, what's interesting is on the one hand, well, you've touched on several interesting points. One is this kind of conception of hell, you know, what is it to be damned, or what is it, you know, what does that look like from your perspective? And you play with that concept of, you know, maybe hell is, you know, being stuck in a pattern. It's not necessarily a place as much as it's a pattern of existence. And so hell could be kind of returning to, you know, embodied life, and but having to kind of relive, you know, the pain that one goes through, and therefore being damned because one can't break that. The other is the, and I off the top of my head can't remember the name of the Greek the Greek figure who pushes the stone up the hill over and over again, right, and has it roll down. And the interesting thing you play with is perhaps the stone, you know, perhaps he doesn't have to push the stone up the hill. And perhaps he can just push it a little farther so it doesn't roll down. You know, there's choice and agency amongst this thing that is what seems to be damning, and that there is a way out, And I appreciate that. Appreciate you kind of going into that in depth in the last part of your book. And I think that that's good. And I think in, you know, I mean, I know it's where it's not the typical kind of breezy, trashy summer read that somebody's going to grab, you know, for the beach per se, but not everybody wants that kind of breezy stuff. So, but you know, people deal with, and I've been in a conversation with somebody recently, kind of pastoral conversation. They're dealing with an immense amount of guilt, and they're trying to wrap their head around it, and it really isn't solvable guilt, and it's really not. It's not guilt that they are for. It's guilt by, if you will, omission. This person lost a spouse to suicide, and they feel guilty for not being able to be there with that person. And the truth is, as we understand suicide, is that it's very complex, and the reason why people do it, is, you know, kind of a coming together, a confluence of many things at the same time. But the people who are around the aftermath of that, the wake of it, if you will, in that sense, both the wake as in the water, but not, and the wake of
Right, the
mourning.
turmoil, exactly.
Yeah, playing with your word there, is how do I resolve, how do I move on when my life hasn't been, you know, things didn't, I either did something or didn't do something, and that was unable to stop or help, you know, someone in need, which is exactly in a sense of what the mind experiment that you're playing with, you know, as a writer here, is that you're going into what if I acted differently? Could the outcome have been different? And I think there are a lot of people that are actually, you know, struggling with that kind of guilt and remorse and regret that would find this book interesting.
For sure. I mean, there's kind of the, it's not the first line, but really the crux of the book is this line that echoes each other. And the line is, there is no crime to fit this sentence. There is no sentence to fit this crime. And whether we're talking about resurrecting the wood atop Golgotha or one's own personal struggle, it is that sort of, again, existentialist conflict of sort of fate versus faith and choice versus choicelessness, and how do you break, like, to your point, how do the only way to break that cycle is through some passage of self-realization. It's not going to come from those who pass judgment, those who write the law, for instance. It's through a journey of self-discovery and self-release, frankly. I'm the furthest thing from a therapist or a psychiatrist, but in kind of casting this tale and retelling of Judas and Pilate and sort of examining their struggle of self-punishment and self-doubt, it was really, it was a question of, do they possess the ability and the power to, unburden themselves from their own chains, so they can reflect on what role did they play? And again, these are two characters that, are have become two, kind of these abstract figures, right? They're these sort of abstract adjectives. They're these violent, villainous verbs. And what I found interesting in kind of looking at their tale in particular was, which was at first so kind of alarming and then became so liberating, what was how much we don't know and how much w is not written about these two characters, historically speaking. And we and so this idea of what became this process of sort of deconstructing, there's almost a Mandela effect around Judas Iscariot and Pontius Pilate. I think we, when you just say the term, right, we have, whether it's weakness, whether it's rage and betrayal, whether it's puppets, there's a whole backstory. A very three-dimensional web is woven in all of our minds about these two characters. And what was so fascinating was having to kind of unravel, unweave, and deconstruct what I thought I knew about these two characters relative to what's actually known about them, which is ultimately very little, if not a blank canvas. So they're out of the gate sort of suggested there's an opportunity to, from a creative point of view anyway, without contradicting biblical narrative, historical narrative, there was an opportunity to create that backstory, to create what was their journey to Gethsemane, what was their journey to Herod's temple, what was their journey to the base of Calvary Hill, yet alone what was their journey, not only up the hill but down the hill, and for the centuries afterwards. And so that became a very liberating process because I was nervous about having to dance around, again, kind of a historical construct, and sort of come to realize that actually there is a pretty two-dimensional narrative that exists in religion and in history and even pop culture, that I, there exists that opportunity to reimagine that tale and to give it some, to give it, with absolute creative and poetic license, right? This is, first and foremost, this is a literary thriller. I'm not trying to recast or recreate history or challenge or complement any kind of biblical narrative. This is a thriller first and foremost. But I think two characters that I think at least deserve a conversation about what was their journey. And if again, coming at it from a place of faith, if I approach Calvary Hill and Golgotha with the sense of, the erection of the wood and the resurrection of the man and the Son of God had to happen, let's talk about those who enabled that moment. And were they betrayers or were they enablers? Did they, in fact? And again, these are things that you see in pop culture. You look at Andrew Lloyd Webber's Jesus Christ Superstar, that the raises those same questions about, Judas having that harder job and having to make that choice and to play the role of the villain and betrayer. And knowing that he alone would be damned for this, but yet this moment had to occur atop Golgotha. And so, I'm not trying to paint them in any heroic tones, but I think there's a conversation to be had around, their, again, sort of their cursed tumble through history since is at least a fascinating conversation.
As you say, that tumble through history, they are they've become metaphors. They have become these, they've grown beyond, their names, their words have grown beyond themselves, the characters themselves, to the point where it doesn't matter who they were, and nor does it matter that we have very little information on them. And I thought, for one, as a Christian professional, I sat back and said, yeah, no, there's nothing here that you are digging away at the orthodoxy of what Christians believe. There's not you're not do, you know There's no heresy here, in terms of you approaching the story of Good Friday and the crucifixion of Jesus, and I think all of that is that's good, because you don't want to write off a whole a whole segment of potential readers. But so you do a nice job there, honoring the biblical text by not undermining the biblical text. So it's there, but you move off of it or touch to it just to say, yep, these characters were there, but this is not, this is not, you're not trying to say something about something that would upset, directly upset, the central tenets of Christianity. There's none of that. So, I do think it's interesting that you are touching on this kind of how to what is existence? What is life after death? What does that mean? And that sense of, just to come back to that past lives for a minute, is not an unknown concept to first century Jewish history, so or early Christian history, the biblical text, because we have people, asking the disciples in particular, and Jesus asking them, who do people say that I am? And they say some say you're Elijah, some say you're Moses, and so the only it's kind of we read if we read that honestly and kind of pause for a minute and kind of go, because it's a segment, right in the narrative, and the minute after that, Peter says, well, you're the Messiah, he gets praised, and then he says, then he upsets Jesus. And, then it's get behind me, Satan. So all of that's said right there. So we move past this sense of staring us in the face as a sense of a concept that people were holding then, that, yeah, Elijah could return in the body of somebody else. What is this thing? So it's not, you're not even, we don't address it doctrinally, but it's there, and we just kind of ignore it and skip over it and not do it. So you're even there. You're not going beyond things. I do wonder. I would love your thoughts of good and evil. In that sense, you have at least one character who does something horrible, and it kind of asks the question. I want to ask you that question. Readers might think about this. It's like, well, okay, well, how do you see people? Do you see that? Do you see people as inherently good or incorruptible or potentially evil, and somehow corrupted? How do you, or do people have good, people are kind of neutral and have a choice of being on the good side of the ledger or the bad side of the ledger?
Yeah, so the heady question. But ultimately, my philosophy that I think dictated sort of the written page in this instance, this is taking a moment of, again, the crucifixion atop Golgotha. This is an incredibly violent, painful example in many ways of the worst of humanity, the extremes. And I think a lot of the book deals with sort of this relationship between religion and capital punishment. And that's a very relevant conversation today. And the extremes for which we go to in the name of certain divinities transcends all cultures and mythologies and religions. But in considering this kind of this conflict and conquest of true goodness atop a hill, this is we're starting with this moment of this sort of this epiphany of light, that for me is just simply someone as faith and as a writer, and maybe also partly schooled by my Jesuit education. If I were to accept this greater presence of divinity and goodness, as also a student of science, to me, what's equally indisputable then is the presence of something else, the binary opposite, right? And true goodness doesn't just exist in my mind in isolation. And so it is this struggle of good and evil, that and that tension and that friction that exists in every soul that equally existed atop Golgotha. And so for me, history and every soul that's walked on this earth, from the moment of go up until the conversation we're having today, it is that same struggle. And so the long short of it is, do I believe people are inherently good or inherently bad? Neither, but do I think that we have that North Pole and South Pole and every layer of friction, in between? Absolutely, right? And so this is that these are the challenges that we face in every step. And in considering kind of the good and evil, and considering Judas and Pilate, and in considering where the story started with this sort of this notion of sort of heroes and anti-heroes, I was sort of struck with sort of the Freudian notion of ego and it, right? And it's that same strength and weakness, goodness and evil, forward and backward relationship that we all struggle with, again, up our own daily hills and on our own generational hills. And so, to answer your question of sort of where do I stand in kind of that presence of both, I think, ultimately, we are all very fallible, in our own timeless through our own narrow histories, and it's because of these two magnetic competing compasses, of again, whether those terms are goodness and evil, light and darkness, heaven or hell, it's that is as real as the physical world around us, sort of the magnetic forces that impact the very earth that rotates. And so to me, that's just, again, part of that, just a fascinating discussion. And so again, what with some, for instance, with Judas and Pilate, to your point, they've been conveniently cast as, well, they're just bad, right? I mean, whether they're sort of seeds of Lucifer or they were sort of pawns that were delegated this role. But why then should they be exempt from this struggle? Why can't they have this polar struggle? And so let's give them the dimensionality and the space and the conversation, to reflect on their choices, and to suffer from their choices, and to suffer their own damnation. And so, again, it's fascinating that there are very few other actual, real, historical people that have walked this earth that don't get the benefit of the doubt of that sort of suggestion of, well, what was their agency? What was their context? We can look at some of historical's most notorious characters, from Genghis Khan to Adolf Hitler, and yet somehow so many of these people are at least given the space of a real historical analysis. Yet, for to me, a fascinating reason, the characters of Judas Iscariot and Pontius Pilate have really, and I'm not talking about sort of academic circles, but who haven't been afforded the opportunity of that context of life and choice and struggle, which to me is, it's man, that it, it's kind of a breathtaking, sort of suggestion, right? When you think of, it's a very small cast that somehow we just collectively, historically, through religion, and history, just don't afford them that opportunity. And to me, that's a fascinating why. Why don't we, and not just as practicing Catholics, this far surpasses, religion. Why is it that, we don't, we hesitate to, it's when we say the names and the terms Judas and Pilate, it's like saying Macbeth in a theater. Like, just their names alone are taboo. And that's, to me, that's fascinating, because you can also look at it from the sense of, they enabled this incredible revolution, this incredible enlightenment, this incredible revelation. This very thing that billions of souls that have worn crosses that dangle close to their heart, let's consider that violent moment on a hill and all of its repercussions and all of its glory, mind you. And so again, this is not painting a negative stroke or brush on the narrative of religious history. It's maybe broadening the perspective just to consider the broader cast of characters.
Yeah, no, that's that I think that's important. What you reminded me of is, why might one reason why we might talk about or not talk about these characters, and they're certainly mentioned, they're familiar names to practicing Christians, but and then perhaps less so to non-practicing Christians, although both of their names are so tied into, Western literature, and to not know about them, one might run into problems on the AP English exam, or some other reading of some literature in college, and not be aware of what the author is referencing. So, but beyond that, what's interesting you bring up, and this kind of cultural shaming that goes on, that we see that you're bringing to light here, perhaps, is also something that we can see in other places, or that sense of that J.K. Rowling brings up with Voldemort. We don't say his name. There is that kind of that it's something so heinous that we won't say the name. Now, of course, we can't get enough of Hitler's name, and so interestingly, but on another note, I'm reminded of things like the Sandy Hook tragedy, the elementary school shootings, where we know the names of the children, particularly if you're around the area, that they were killed, and what soon happened afterwards. They'd say, well, there were 26 victims, if memory serves me right, 26 children, but there really were 27 who were killed, right? Adam Lanza was killed, but we don't speak his name because of, in a sense of, not because of this, as some movements will say, say his name, kind of being called out, as we've had in the past decade or so. This is, no one will say, no one brings him up, and nor is anyone interested in examining his motives. And so it's interesting, if you take two characters that are fundamentally kind of shamed in history, and bring them out, and kind of, bring them into light, and say, well, let's look at what might be their motives, and let's look at what might have influenced them. And I think that that's healthy. That's a healthy part of what you're asking.
And I think, again, coming to it from a place of faith, we're not, at its core, we're not starting with this horrific tragedy of a school shooting. We're starting from this, yes, very violent, very painful moment, but ultimately of our ultimate conquest. This is a moment of triumph. This is a moment of, a cross and a crucifix. This is the ultimate symbol of, ironically, given the violent nature of it, of peace and harmony and conquest. And so I find it fascinating that those who shan't be named or spoken of were the two most pivotal characters that enabled this moment of triumph. Yes, it's, often regarded as man's darkest moment, but also man's brightest moment. And so again, that conflict, it's, I find so fascinating, because if this was the moment that reset our calendar, then therefore, those who enabled it, and again, I'm not suggesting in any way, shape, or form should be glorified, but I'm certainly suggesting, it's a conversation that shouldn't be diminished or sort of two-dimensionalized.
No, I think you're right, absolutely right with that. And I think it's in, certainly with whether for a new Christian or a seasoned Christian, if you will, kind of considering, just kind of passing over quickly the unsavory characters, figures of the time of what we call Holy Week, is it shows a lack of willingness to consider the depth and darkness of humanity, and to these were humans that did this, and both these two characters and the other religious leaders that were not named really, but were around that you touch on and bring to light as well. So
Yeah,
that's important. Yeah, go ahead.
interesting because again, sort of this shadow of two-dimensionality, it transcends just the Judas. And again, outside of kind of sort of Christian academia, this shadow transcends just Judas and Pilate, right? That same almost simplification really of sort of, if you look at how Herod, has been translated through history. If you look at how, in terms of sort of this gluttonous character, if you look at sort of Caiaphas, right, and one might argue is on an almost a very anti-Semitic, conniving sort of two-dimensionality. It's fascinating to me. And in many ways, and again, you would know much more than I, but in many ways, even the disciples relative to this very particular chapter of what's become Holy Week, sort of their passages and journeys and motivations and steps towards, starting with kind of the Last Supper and then in the Garden of Gethsemane to the aftermath of the opening of the tomb. It's a really interesting brush that has been painted for all of those who played this pivotal role, including, one might argue, both Marys as well, when it comes to this chapter. So to me, it's just this, again, it's a fascinating opportunity to get a little bit uncomfortable, frankly, and wrestle with the violence and wrestle with the shadows and wrestle with the guilt and wrestle with maybe the hope, wrestle with the intentions without necessarily dirtying or casting a different light or a shadow, on Christ's journey, right? Like that is what it is. And that is what is written and that is what is believed and that is what is debated, but that's not the sandbox that I'm playing with for sure. And I think that we're talking about that I just think is interesting because when you look at, man's most pivotal moments and whether it's recent history and whether we're talking about World War I or whether we're talking of, there's multiple phases throughout history. It's just interesting how this most pivotal week and chapter gets, it has a different stroke. It has a different aura around its cast of characters. And I wonder why an examination of that in many ways has become so taboo. And there's almost a sense of, and again, I sort of held my breath a little bit too as I started going down this path. Like, do I dare even suggest or mess with kind of intentions and aftermaths and a 21st century reimagining, of these characters. Again, whether we're also talking about, Barabbas and we're talking about Lazarus and again, these are incredibly creative and mythological characters, but if we're starting from a place of no, actually these are real historical people, well, then let's treat them as such.
Right. And they have feelings and they have motivations and they have hopes and they have failings and all of that. And I appreciate you, kind of getting into that in ways that were, kind of it certainly made me stop and go, huh, how I hadn't thought about Barabbas or I hadn't thought about Judas in that way. I've spent more time with Pilate, but because there is a little bit more on him, but but these other characters and say, yeah, they play a central role. And what would they have been thinking, in these moments? And I think that's you played with that in your writing, you addressed it, you looked at it and kind of turned the stone over a couple times to see, huh, what does this really look like? I'm also interested, and again, you treat it pretty much, kind of right down the middle in terms of you opened the door to the concept of Satan or the devil. You kind of you it it's and I think you do it in a way that is believable for modern readers. And I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that.
So, again, I think it has to do with this. If we're talking about this conquest of goodness, then this presence, what I've sort of constructed and cast literally and figuratively, is sort of this shadow Well, then that must have been present then and every moment since. And so, because this is the struggle that this entire journey up Calvary Hill is frankly all about. And so, without that opposing binary force, kind of what's the point? And so what I wanted to do was sort of carefully create when there's good intention. Of course, there's malintention. And if when there's good intention, it may come from within and it may come from a place of divinity and spirituality. So then therefore, when that malintent arises, then that equally comes from a shadowy source. And so what I wanted to do was sort of address certain motivations. And so part of it is in if we're starting with the act of crucifixion, and mind you, again, it's worth reminding, crucifixion and other forms of capital punishment have existed since, the dawn of man. And so it's not like there was just the one. And so when we're talking about this incredibly violent act, then it's a question of, okay, let's consider that act too in a modern setting. And it is that very, as you referenced earlier in the conversation, this violent, horrific, horrible act that this modern character imposes on three innocent men in modern day New York that kind of brings these modern iterations of Judas and Pilate together. And so to me, this presence and this purpose of this fallen angel, right? That so again, kind of going back to Calvary and the lion's share of this book, it's a 21st century book. There's whispers and echoes that go back to ancient Jerusalem and ancient Rome. But to me, kind of the play there was, if we're talking about the story of Christ, then you can't talk about the story of Christ without the story of the fallen angel and Lucifer and what the open tomb represented. And to me, as sort of a creative sort of subplot was the open tomb, while it represented this victorious ascension, also represented the opportunity for this fallen angel to get back in, right? To get back up, to reclaim this purpose. And so it's sort of a it became a literary kind of avenue as we follow Pilate and Judas's sort of tumble and their 2,000-year sort of course of damnation. There's sort of this parallel track of this shadowy, shadowed presence that also has its own purpose and is also struggling and fighting to reclaim its place above. And so how do we then explain some of these violent acts and some of these malintents? And it's because, again, whether it existed in the Garden of Eden and whether it exists in Central Park today, sort of this presence and this shadow, as and where there is light, there is darkness and shadow. And so without kind of creating this sort of this Lucifer type of devil character, it's a question of when that malintent and when that shadow takes hold, just as it does with goodness and divinity, it informs some striking decisions and a striking cycle of intent and so that became an interesting, again, kind of an interesting sandbox to play in.
Yeah, that's good. Is there just a couple more questions here, just in, to wrap up? Is I wonder, do you have anything that I haven't touched on today, or any questions that I haven't addressed, or topics that you'd want the reader, the listener today, and the future reader to be aware of?
No, yeah. I mean, I would say, to me, I think especially when considering this story in the context of a primarily Christian audience, I find that, again, I find myself sort of tiptoeing sometimes, and again, coming from a Catholic upbringing and a place of faith, to sort of suggest that, this story that starts atop Calvary Hill, and kind of it's the violent occurrence and the violent aftermath. It's very much this story of this relationship between religion and capital punishment, between the religion and law. To me, there was a sort of a side point. There's a fascinating historical parallel between the law and religion. And despite the fact that, again, and this was true in ancient Jerusalem, just as it is in modern day New York City, we believe sort of this construct of the separation of church and state. And yet when you look at the parallel truths of the viaticum, right, the role that religion plays in the execution chamber, and what a strict religious process and procedure, even when we as the state are taking a life, just as we did atop Calvary Hill. It's fascinating how close these paths still remain. It's fascinating the relationship just between a body of 12 disciples, how that morphed into a body of 12 jurors. And just to me, this incredibly gray area that I had to also deconstruct of the relationship between law and religion, especially when it comes to capital punishment. Because when you think of crucifixion, again, it's one of those terms that, again, crucifixion is a term that, we barely allow in the human psyche, yet alone come out of the human mouth in terms of the act. It's a word when you say crucifixion, it almost stings on its way out. It's something we tiptoe around. And yet it's an interesting reminder that when we're considering, and again, not the original, but the most infamous crucifixion, at its core, this was not only just a form of capital punishment, but this trial and this particular execution was just that. It was the state putting a man to death. And so the story of even Christ's journey to Golgotha and beyond, looking at it through the lens of crime and punishment, right? This is a story of crime and punishment. Not just Christ's crime and his punishment, and the conversation around that, but then again in the aftermath, what was Judas's crime? What was Pilate's crime? What was their punishments? What were and what are and what still is their sentence? And so to answer your question, I think this is also as much a tale about capital punishment, the consideration of the violence of the act, and again, just as it is the religion, this is not about a pro and a con. This is a thriller that kind of gives room and oxygen to have a dialogue around some of these topics, and I think from a different perspective.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. So, and I would also say for just those Christians who were, I think, rightly hesitant with Dan Brown's examinations of like the Holy Grail in his books, and kind of playing on the conspiracy of the church and wanting to have that. This is not that kind of book. I mean, it's while you're dealing with churchy things and things of historical importance to the church, you don't undermine, someone's not going to read this and go, oh, my faith has been undermined, or don't read this book because it's going to force you to question the centrality of faith. No, it brings to light additional facets. It's as if looking at a flower from a different side and still seeing its importance and beauty.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point. And so in my sort of my wildest dreams, what my kind of initial intention was in many ways was to extract these two characters of Judas Iscariot and Pontius Pilate and take them out of the Bible and ultimately kind of put them in more of a Shakespearean context. Right. And I'm not necessarily comparing this to Shakespeare. I'm saying just to delicately extract them from a biblical context. We know them as the biblical context and then put them in a very real context. One that's obviously very dramatic and has whispers back to these historical events that happen to be, so again, it's sort of saying, no, I'm accepting and embracing biblical truth as historical truth. So let's take these characters out and put them in this historical analysis, and then sort of play with them in modern day. So I think that's a good point. And I was quite careful to do that. So I'm not, as you say, sort of kind of going down the Dan Brown route, which, you know, to me is those are, you know, absolutely brilliant and masterful and playful thrillers that in their own way are also sort of in parallel tracks, sort of challenging sort of church narratives. And you know, I'm staying really sort of intentionally clear of that, probably because I'm not interested in that. I'm not interested in church narrative and church history, if you will. I'm more interested with kind of that cultural. Like if you look, so I'm incredibly lucky that I now live primarily in the heart of Tuscany, and I have a property, a vineyard that exists very close to Florence, and I'm surrounded by this incredible Renaissance art, and that's the reason I bring this up. But again, what's so striking if you're walking through the Uffizi or any church within a 200-mile radius of Florence, and beyond, actually, you know, again, it's if you look at even Renaissance art, you know, again, there's a very particular, almost convenient narrative that sort of transcended religious history just into history and into artifacts. To me, is just interesting. And so, if anything, what I'm challenging is kind of just the cultural interpretation of the reality of what happened 2,000 years ago, without questioning and fully embracing and accepting. So it's
Yeah, no, I could see how you've definitely looked at plenty of art in Italy. I have too. And what you've done is, yeah, in some sense, across the ages, is art has been a means of interpretation of history, and let's say in particular the medieval and then the Renaissance artists were open to examining biblical scenes, biblical events, and putting their own thoughts and feelings on it, which, you know, which is a which allows it allows the viewer to expand their mind and behold what the text, what the scripture story is saying in new ways. So I think it's you're taking something that has certainly been on, you know, kind of a tool in the toolbox, maybe today is a little dusty and rusty, and taking it off and kind of polishing it up and saying, here, you know, this is something for us to use and consider when we're thinking about some of these folks. So, you know, that's good. So okay. So in the acknowledgments, as I just verify here, no, in the afterward, no, author's notes, you finish with, you're smiling, you know where I'm going. You finish with these two sentences, four words, and they say, look closer and listen. And so my ask is, because I came to that point and I said, okay, what are you calling the reader to do? What is that action? Because it's you're asking us to finish the book and now to consider something or to do something. So would you lean into that, help us understand it a
Sure,
little bit better?
sure. So those are words, and those are kind of an exclamation that plays a role in the book, and is whispered in Aramaic and is whispered in Latin, from both dark, shadowy places and context to inspirational, enlightened places. And so, ultimately, and again, things that we've touched on, I'm approaching this moment atop Golgotha with that Freudian ego and id. I'm approaching it from there are two sides to every story. There are two sides to every hill. And sort of the look closer and listen was sort of my takeaway when I first read Nikos Kazantzakis' Last Temptation of Christ. And it enabled me just that starting perspective of be open to both sides of the story, be open to both sides of the hill, and be open to both sides of the soul. And so it's not a question then of, you know, again, it's not a question of sort of look closer and challenge. It's a question of The listening part was, be open to the suggestion that there are two sides to the story. And frankly, and again, it's something that it feels taboo to say, but be open to not challenge what happened atop Golgotha, but be open to the fact that there are multiple perspectives to how the cross was erected. There are multiple perspective on how the stone was rolled. There are two perspectives to damnation. There are two perspectives to Judas and Pilate and their context. And so that's really just that kind of call to action of it's not only is it okay to question, you have to assume that there's two sides to that story. And I think in doing so, again, from my perspective, I find that faith affirming. I find that historically empowering. So that's really where that line comes from, and comes from that plans. And again, I think partly kind of a Jesuit training of, to not take characters or history at face value. And the adage of history, and it's true with biblical history too, history is only, kind of written by the victors, if you will. But look at it from the victims' side as well, not just the conquerors, but the conquered. And I think you'll it I think that's an empowering suggestion.
Great. Well, Daniel Grace, thank you so much for being on Courage to Thrive. Really enjoyed having you on. And good luck with the book. I hope the vigorous sales for you and your debut model.
Thank you so much.
Model.
Just I'm all about just
Yeah.
vigorous conversations. So I
Yeah.
appreciated ours today. And it was an honor to be on with you.
Yeah,
Great. Great.
wonderful. Thank you so much, Reverend Dr. Robert Flanagan, host of Courage to Thrive on Courage 2, number 2, thrive.com and Courage2thrive.tv. So you can see all of our episodes. This is episode 9 with Daniel Grace, author In the Wake of Golgotha. Really interesting, fascinating conversation, gentlemen. Thank you so much for being on the show. You're watching Incandescent Radio and Incandescent TV, and the show is also on Spotify, iHeart, and Apple Podcasts. So we will talk to you soon next month on Courage to Thrive. Take good care.